From time to time, I think it's good to discuss some very basic questions of life. And I think there could not be anything more foundational to our existence than to ask, is there a God? Pretty foundational, isn't it? Pretty basic. Are we here by some quirk of fate? Just some monumental random accident that somehow we evolved as human beings on this planet in the right place at the right time? Is there no more meaning than to just enjoy what we can for 60, 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 years? And then that's all there is. Earlier this week, Hazel Whitley introduced us to a lady that's 100 years old at the facility where she is living. She's in a walker. She's using a walker, but she's just bebopping around and perky and alert and sharp and bright and lively. I thought, wow, this is great. So some people live to 100 and they do great with it. You know, others don't make it that far. But if God doesn't exist, then regardless of how long we live, pretty sad to think that's all there is, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty depressing, actually, to think about that. Now, many people wrestle with that question. And sometimes people, if they pray, they think, well, it's just an exercise in futility. Is there really anybody there? And if they are there, do they care? Why do I go through this exercise? Now, we read in Psalm 14 an interesting statement. It's attributed to David in the heading of the psalm. Psalm 14, verse 1, makes this statement about believing in God and believing in his existence, that he is there. Psalm 14 and verse 1, it says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." God says, anyone who says, "I don't exist," he said, they're a fool. Now, he goes on to talk about some of the evil that comes about when people don't believe in God, when they deny God's existence. And you can read different things about fool and how fool is used in the Bible as someone who is evil compared to someone who is righteous and trying to obey God and following what God says to do. But God tells us very clearly through David that you're a fool if you say there's no God. And we could use any number of titles for a message like this. We've used many titles in booklets and articles in the church in the past about does God exist, or is God there, or is he there? And I've simply titled this, "Is God There? Is He There?" It's about as simple as I can think of to title it. And it's really one of those most crucial bits of information we could ever hope to discover. Because if God is there, then there are a lot of other important questions we have to ask. Okay, God does exist. God did create us. Why? Why are we here? What's the purpose in life? And if we come to an answer of what's the purpose in life, what does God want us to do? Does he have rewards? Does he have punishments? And how do we receive the rewards rather than the more negative side of things? There are a lot of very important questions that follow whether we decide, or once we decide, there is a God. If he isn't there, if life is just an accident, some random spontaneous occurrence, well, then life really has little to offer except what joys we can experience in this physical life. And then that's it. I want to begin by talking about some of the reasons people give for not believing in God. I've heard different reasons, and I don't have an exhaustive list, but I've did a Google search, so I'm now wise, right? You can search, you can find anything on the internet. But it was interesting. I thought, well, let me just Google why people don't believe in God. And of course, several things came up that I'd heard before, that I've read before in different places. So here are some of the reasons people say they don't believe in God. Here's one. Says, if God really existed, he wouldn't allow all the evil we see in the world. Some look around and they see evil, like many of the things we see happening in today's news, and they say, well, there can't be a God because surely he wouldn't let all that evil stuff happen. If he's there, he would stop it. He would intervene. Well, we realize that's not God's purpose at this point. Oh, I guess I better not explain each of these as I go along. I won't get through the questions, will I? Anyway, here's another one. I prayed desperately for help in a serious situation and God did not answer. So in their mind, means God's not there. He isn't there if he doesn't answer. If he doesn't give me the answer I want. Here's another one. Belief in God is superstition. That has no place in the modern world. We don't need any superstition. Some people view it that way. Here's one that seemed to be quite popular for some time. I think some have begun to realize it doesn't have all the answers, but this one says science has removed the need for God. Science has replaced God. We don't need God because now we have science. Well, we're learning more and more that science doesn't have all the answers. Here's one that people sometimes use. You cannot prove non-material things. How do you prove something that you can't put your finger on, something that you can't hold, something that you can't look at and measure? You can't prove non-material things. And we have to admit there is a certain level of faith involved in belief in God. There's a huge chunk of faith involved in believing in evolution. Right? Yeah, okay. All right. There is a faith factor, though, right? So, all right, may have a little bit there. You cannot prove it to someone, especially who doesn't want to believe it. Here's another one. Some people who claim to believe in God are obnoxious or hypocritical. You ever heard that one? Well, they're just hypocrites. So, they, you know, God doesn't exist because we're projecting our thoughts on God and the thoughts of other and the actions of other people on God. Well, again, believing in God, here's the one I really like. Believing in God would interfere with my lifestyle. That's probably the most honest one that I saw. It would interfere with my lifestyle. Well, we could answer each of these objections, and some call them reasons, and probably fill the rest of the time of the message. But if we really look at some of the reasons to believe in God, I think those kind of answer those objections, at least the root. So I'd like to take that second approach. So let's talk a little bit about reasons why we should believe God is there. Let's go first of all to Romans chapter 1. I want to read a little section from Romans 1, verses 18 through 20. We recognize that creation is an incredible thing. And I do have a clip. They're going to get the projector ready here in a minute. Romans chapter 1, beginning of verse 18. Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." Lots of ungodliness and unrighteousness in that verse, isn't there? "Because," verse 19, what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even as eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." God is saying through Paul, he inspired Paul to write to the church at Rome and preserve for us, that you can see God. You can see his invisible attributes by the things that he's created. They are a proof of him. Now, verse 19 is a little bit awkwardly translated. My New King James has a marginal rendering for this. It says, "Because what may be known from God is manifest," it says evident in the margin. Instead of "in them," it says "among them." What may be known of God is evident among them, for God has shown it to them. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen by what he has made. So it is the creation. God says, my hand in the creation shows who I am. It shows what I'm like. It proves that I'm there. Again, the theory of evolution, which has been accepted as fact by many, is a huge and important topic. We have a lot of articles on our LHT website. If you go to the search box and just type in evolution, you'll get, I think it's like 10 pages worth of articles that talk about evolution and various aspects of evolution. There's discussion even about microevolution versus macroevolution. You know, we've talked about that in the church sometimes, that microevolution is that minor change within a species where they adapt and things change a little bit within that same species. That, we believe, does take place. But macroevolution, where something goes from one species to become another species, is false. It's never been proven. Fish don't become birds. You know, species do not become something else. There's never been proof of that. We don't believe in that. But back to the point of Romans 1. The point is that God says, you can see that I am there by what I have created. I've always enjoyed science. I remember back in high school science class learning about molecular and atomic structure and just being so impressed that it's like a miniature solar system. You know, when you start looking at everything that God has made, there's order. There is beauty to it. There is symmetry to it. And of course, whole lot more has been learned in the 30 years, 40 years, since 50 years since I was in high school science. But it all comes down to saying the same thing. It is orderly. It is systematic. And it follows certain laws that do not change. It's God's hand is evident even at the tiniest level. I was given a copy of a video titled The Privileged Planet some years back. It's a little dated now, perhaps, but the whole hour-long video talks about some of the unique things about our planet. That we are in a place in the universe that would support life. And there's only a narrow band around our sun, and it's the only kind of sun that could support life. And there's only a narrow band in which the Earth could be, and life would be able to exist. That water wouldn't boil away or freeze. I spoke about water at the feast in Colorado this last year. Some of its incredible properties and how crucial those are to life. The Earth has a moon that helps move tides and cleanses the water by moving it around. Incredible what scientists have learned. I want to play a clip from that show or from that video, Our Incredible Planet, Privileged Planet. So we'll pick it up from there with the video.
For centuries, the fact that we can discover things about the universe has really been something of a mystery. Why would beings like ourselves be able to discover a universe like this? Why is what we think about the universe, why would it correspond to the way things really are?
Our ability to discern and understand the universe is a fundamental part of what makes the universe tick, so that we're linked into it. This isn't just a sort of an accident, a trivial little byproduct. It is something that is linked to the great cosmic scheme of things. Now, I've no idea how that linkage works, why it's there, or anything of that sort, but I'm very, very struck by the fact that we can understand the universe in such exquisite detail and at such a deep level.
The spectacular progress of modern astronomy and physics is the product of a universe accessible to the human eye and mind. It is a universe governed by laws and forces that literally hold our planet Earth and the entire cosmos together and are finely calibrated to allow for both complex life and scientific discovery.
If you didn't have something like gravity that pulled matter together, you would never get planets, you wouldn't get stars, you wouldn't get any complex organisms. If you didn't have the strong nuclear force, there would be nothing to hold protons and neutrons together in the nucleus. And so you wouldn't have any atoms, so no chemistry. If you didn't have the electromagnetic force, you would have no bonding between chemicals. You'd have no light, and the list goes on. So you need all these sorts of fundamental principles have to be in place in order for life to occur. Wipe out one of those principles, wipe out one of those laws, no life.
During the past 40 years, scientists have determined the relative strengths of each of these primary laws and forces. These strengths are so critically balanced, they are often described as being finely tuned.
If you're to take the basic fundamental constants of nature and you were to change these even slightly, or you were to pick their values at random, you would almost never get a universe that would be habitable in any sort of way. That is, you couldn't have galaxies, you couldn't have planets, you couldn't have complex biological organisms if these fundamental constants were even slightly different, slightly stronger, slightly weaker than they actually are in this universe. That's the idea of fine-tuning.
To better appreciate this concept, imagine a machine able to control the strengths of each of the physical constants. If you changed even slightly from its current setting, the strength of any one of these fundamental forces, such as gravity, the impact on complex life would be catastrophic.
If you increased it by a little bit, no large-scale life forms could exist. Anything that was more than the size of a pea would be completely crushed. So you might be able to get life of a very, very primitive sort, such as bacteria, but you could never get conscious observers.
This is one of a long list of properties in underlying physics that seem to be prerequisites for a universe with life. For example, the strengths of the other forces are all important, the masses of the various subatomic particles. If all of these things were even a little bit different, then life, certainly life as we know it, could not exist.
These forces and constants are another example of the correlation between life and discovery. For not only are they finely tuned for our existence, they can also be understood.
It's remarkable how well the laws work. And not only that, it's remarkable how simple they are. And that also is related to the discoverability of the laws.
Albert Einstein wrote, "I have deep faith that the principles of the universe will be both beautiful and simple." For nearly 400 years, scientists have discovered an elegant simplicity in the mathematical equations that express and unlock the laws of the cosmos.
It's been said that many of the most important theories in theoretical physics can be written on a single sheet of paper. And this, I think, ought to be considered surprising, that such a simple formula or equation could have such far-reaching applications to a very complicated and very large universe.
Let's go ahead and stop it there.
Yes, a universe.
Goes on to talk about more of those aspects of how we can discover things, and that we are in the right place, even in our galaxy, to be able to discover the universe. And the laws that are in place, if you change them even just a little bit, life wouldn't exist. And evolutionists want us to believe that all of this happened just by accident. It's amazing the leap of faith they want us to take. I'd like to go to Psalm 19, where David could attest for the beauty of the design of this planet, of human beings, of God's creation. Even 3,000 years ago, without all of the science that has started with Copernicus being able to realize we're not the center of the universe, not even the center of our solar system. But in Psalm 19, beginning in verse 1, David says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tabernacle or a tent or a covering for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man to run his race. Its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there's nothing hidden from its heat." Now, David could look at what he saw around him and see order, saw that there was reliability. There were laws that were constants. And all the additional details that science has been able to discover since then, and since the first century when the book of Romans was written, don't contradict that. They support that. Deeper and deeper into science, and deeper into detail, they prove that God is there. Isaiah 45, in verse 18, through the prophet Isaiah, God makes a statement. Isaiah 45, in verse 18, says, "For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited, I am the Lord. And there is no other." All of these other gods, these nations are worshiping, they're just wood, they're stone, they're metal. They don't have any life. They have no power. They're not God. God says, "I am the one. I'm the one that created it all. And I designed life. I designed this planet for life." Now, we've used statements in the past in our writings about God's existence by saying things like, well, creation requires a creator. Somebody had to create it, had to bring it from nothing. You know, there's the old joke about scientists who said, "We've learned how to create life." You know, and God says, "Okay, well, show me what you can do." They reached down to pick up dirt. He said, no, get your own dirt. Where'd the dirt come from? You know, somebody brought something into existence from nothing. And that's what God has the power to do. Science can only deal with what God has already created. Matter and the universe are all running down. Something had to start it. Something had to begin that. We've talked about design, needing a designer. Watches don't just appear from nothing. Somebody had to think it out. Somebody had to plan it. Somebody had to design it. We talked about lawgivers. If there are laws, somebody has to create that law. Somebody has to sustain that law. So you saw that dial. Just move that dial a little bit of gravity and increase gravity a tiny bit, and we'd all cease to exist. Nothing bigger than a pea could exist because of the force of gravity. So somebody has to sustain those laws. And life requires a life giver, regardless of what is taught in evolution. So creation itself shows that God exists. It really does show that if we're willing to look. Again, reading from the Bible for someone who doesn't want to believe in God, kind of futile, isn't it? Because they're not going to believe what you read. Oh, that's just the imagination of men. It's superstition. But God says that, no, it's not. He says, I'm the one that created it all. The creation proves my existence. What else? What other reasons are there to believe that God is there? Well, a couple of weeks ago in my sermon, How Solid Is Your Worldview, I read a section of Isaiah. Isaiah 41. Let's turn to Isaiah 41. I'd like to read that again. Isaiah 41, beginning in verse 21. Because fulfilled prophecy is another proof of God's existence. And God uses that through Isaiah to write to Israel, ancient Israel. In verse 21, he says, present your case, says the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, says the King of Jacob. Let them bring forth and show us what will happen. Let them show the former things what they were, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them. Or declare to us things to come. Show us the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you are gods. Yes, do good or do evil. I mean, it doesn't matter which it is. Just tell us what's going to happen and see if it comes about. See if you can make it come about. Yes, do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and see it together. Indeed, you're nothing and your work is nothing. He that chooses you is an abomination. You know, this is God's taunt to those who would worship wood and stone and metal, things that man creates on his own and calls a god. They're not gods. They can't do anything. Just the invention, the work of man's hands, using what God has created to form and fashion something, and then calling it a god. Some authors say there are 61 prophecies about Jesus's birth, life, and death that all came true, that were all fulfilled in the New Testament. And those were just the ones about him. There are lots of other prophecies that were fulfilled as well. For example, remember a guy named Joseph who ended up in prison in Egypt, got sold by his brothers, and ended up in Potiphar's house, got accused of something he did not do, got thrown in jail because of it. Potiphar's wife had him thrown in prison. Pharaoh had a dream about fat and skinny cows and about plump and blighted wheat, and none of his wise men could figure out what in the world that meant. Well, God revealed it to Joseph. Genesis chapter 41, we can pick it up with Joseph going to Pharaoh and explaining it from God. Genesis chapter 41, we'll pick it up in verse 28. Verse 28, Genesis 41. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. And the following chapters tell us that it did come to pass, exactly as God had prophesied. He had Pharaoh dream this dream specifically for Joseph, so that Joseph would be able to interpret it. Joseph would be able to be put in charge. Amazing how God works things out at times. Prophecy. God fulfills prophecy. know, God's feasts reveal prophecies about what he has done, but then prophecies about what he is going to do, ultimately for all mankind. And those who lose that understanding about the festivals, they lose a big part of God's truth. They begin to lose a large bit part of what God's plan is. God will bring to pass what he says. God says he cannot lie, and what he has prophesied, he will bring to pass. Another reason that we can believe in God and know that he is there is one that's a little more personal. When I counsel young people who've grown up in the church for baptism, I always come to this point of asking, how do you know God exists? What makes you confident that he's there? And quite often I hear things that revolve around the point of what they've experienced in life. I've seen things work out for me. I've seen God answer prayers. I've seen God do things that I didn't think would happen. I remember something like that myself. It's as though we all have witnessed times when God did intervene, when he answered prayers. Now, Jesus said he would do that, John chapter 14, so we shouldn't be surprised that that happens at times in our life. It's interesting, the sermonette was about prayer and God answering prayers. God does answer prayers. Jesus said he would for his followers. John chapter 14, beginning in verse 12, he says, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these will he do, because I go to my Father." Now, John 14 and verse 13, "And whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it." Now, the next verse goes on to show that there are some factors that also have to be applied to this. We realize this is not a blanket statement. Okay, God, give me $1 million, and God's bound to have to give me $1 million. No, it doesn't work that way. There are things required such as obedience. There are things required such as asking for things that would be good for us. God's not going to give us things that would not be good for us. But we have to keep his commandments, as the next verse says. If we go to 1 John, and go back to 1 John, the letter, the epistle of John, 1 John chapter 5, John here tells us something else about our prayers and about God answering those prayers. 1 John 5 and verse 14, he says, "Now this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we have asked of him. If we ask according to his will, he hears us." If we ask according to his will, even Jesus said, "Not my will, but yours be done." He recognized that God has a bigger view of life. He has a bigger view of our lives. He has a bigger view than we do. And sometimes his answer isn't yes. So unanswered prayer is not a proof that God isn't there. Sometimes it's simply God saying, "No, it's not good for you right now." Or, "No, not now." Or maybe it's just a no. Not now, not ever. We don't always know the answers, do we? But we know that God sometimes does say no. Sometimes he says not now, whichever may be the case. James wrote about how powerful prayer is in the book of James. James chapter 5 makes an amazing statement. In verses 16 to 18, he says, "Confess your trespasses or faults to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." It accomplishes a lot. An effective, fervent prayer of someone who's striving to obey God. Elijah, verse 17, was a man with a nature just like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. And prayer is powerful. And God, when he answers, we need to take note. We need to remember those things. As I think back on my life, one of the most powerful events in my early life was an instant healing on our way back from the feast. My father had been ordained an elder and down the road here in Big Sandy in 1964, Passover season of 1964. So it was after that. We were on our way back home from the feast. And I would have been in my early teens. And we were pulling a trailer that my parents had bought. And we camped in the Piney Woods for years. And the windows were down because Dad didn't want to overheat the engine. It was hot. So we had the windows down. That was our air conditioning, 460 air conditioning. All the windows down. My arm was on the armrest, and all of a sudden I felt something. My arm just started burning. My whole arm was tingling. And I looked down, and there's a white little furry thing, and I brushed it off. And pretty soon my arm was just throbbing. And I told Dad, and he pulled over to the side of the road, and we went back in the trailer. He looked at it, and he said, "Well, you got bit by an asp." I don't know how it blew in the window, but he got down, knelt down, laid hands on me, and the instant he laid hands on me, the throbbing just quit. Instantly. That was 50 years ago. I still remember it like it was yesterday. It had a big impact on me. I knew God was listening to that prayer, and I knew God answered that prayer. Now, a skeptic would say, "Oh, well, you know, the poison had done its job, and it just dissipated." Or, you know, "Your body just kind of adjusted to it, and you... Or you're such a tough guy that you didn't even notice the pain anymore." No, that's not it. I know what I know. I know what I experienced. We need to take note when God answers prayer. You know, we could read the whole chapter 11 of Hebrews to see answered prayer in action. Sometimes it is dramatic. Sometimes it's like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thrown into a fiery furnace and not a singe on them when they came out. Not even harmed a bit. But you read Hebrews 11 and you see other times the answers to prayer were very simple. People just, they lived. God said move, they moved, they did things on faith, and God blessed them. God gave them answers to their prayers. You know, finding something you've lost, being given favor with a boss. I mean, there are all kinds of answers to prayer. And when we see those answers, we need to pay attention to them. We need to recognize them. So there are many reasons that we can believe in God. Those are just some of them, some of the reasons to believe that God is there. Maybe you've thought of others as I've been speaking. Maybe you've thought of other things that in your life have proved to you that God is there. But going back to those objections that I had at the beginning, science has not replaced God. God is still there, regardless of what science discovers. And some scientists, like we saw in this video clip today, some scientists recognize that what they're seeing is proof that there is order. There is proof that somebody has put us in the right place. What was so interesting about the Privileged Planet is not only are we in the right place in our solar system, we're in the right place in the galaxy. If we were inside one of the arms of the galaxy, we couldn't see space around us. We couldn't see the universe. We're out between the arms, so we can see the rest of the universe. We can discover things. It's as though someone purposely wanted mankind in a location where we could thrive and live and where we could also explore and learn things about the universe. And they said, "Isn't that incredible? What a coincidence." No, they didn't say coincidence. They said, "It's as though it's purposeful that we are here and the universe is discoverable because God put us in the right place." And science, when it's rightly used, can show us God exists. And regardless of what other reasons you see, it is possible to prove non-material things based on what you see, based on the pattern that we see, based on what God has given. He said creation itself proves his existence. I've already mentioned unanswered prayer. It doesn't prove God's not there. It just says maybe the answer is not yet, not now. Maybe the answer is even no. Superstition? I don't know. No, it's not superstition. It's wisdom. Opposed to foolishness. God says it's the fool that doesn't believe in me. It's the fool that believes I'm not there. Now, the one about evil, that is a little difficult. It takes a little bit of time to explain to people. Just because there's evil in the world and God doesn't step in and correct and stop evil isn't a proof that he's not there. Mankind chose to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Some of us were around when we got tired of hearing that sermon, aren't we? We got tired of it at times. But you know, it says so much about our world and so much about what we experience in our world. And until mankind proves to himself that all of the evil that's mixed in with that outweighs whatever good there is, and that man cannot and will not find the answers to his problems without God, we'll never find lasting solutions. The one about people being obnoxious or hypocritical doesn't say anything about God, does it? All that says is we're human. All that says is human beings, even if they believe in God, may not be following God, may not be obeying God. They may believe in God, they may claim to be Christian, but their actions may not prove it. So it's not about God, it's about individual humans who are flawed. I still like the one about believing in God interfering with someone's lifestyle. But you know what that says? It just simply says their lifestyle's not good. It says they need to change their lifestyle. If they want the blessings from God that he wants to give people, he needs to change. They need to change their lifestyle. Humans have been living sinful lifestyles for nearly 6,000 years. And God hasn't wiped us out. And God hasn't corrected all of those sinful lifestyles. He will later, after Christ's return. That's a whole different story. It's a whole other day. Jesus will come back and establish his government and teach obedience to his laws. So I hope this message has given you a little encouragement about the wisdom of believing in God. I hope it's reinforced your belief, because probably all of us sitting here say, well, I believe in God. I believe he's there. But I hope I have done at least a little something to reinforce your faith, to reinforce your belief. God is there, and he does care.